From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. From the Civil War to the Dust Bowl, from baseball to jazz, Ken Burns documentaries have covered a range of critical events in American history and culture. And now,
she's long gone, and now I'm lonesome blue.
Country music is getting the Ken Burns treatment. Burns and longtime collaborators and producers Dayton Duncan and Julie Dunphy spent 8 years researching, making an 8-part, 16-hour documentary premiering in September. GPB is presenting partner for a preview tonight at the Atlanta History Center and on Wednesday, April 10th at Savannah's Jepson Center. You're hearing Hank Williams' Long Gone Lonesome Blues as we kick off a conversation with Dayton Duncan. He's a producer and writer for the series with us from GPB in Savannah. Dayton, welcome.
Great to be here.
Country music rose from the bottom up. That's one of the things we learn early on. So where did the genre really stem from?
Well, we begin our narrative actually in Atlanta when in 1923, when a producing pioneer by the name of Ralph Peer came to Atlanta looking to record what was then called race records, that is, black music. But while he was there, he learned that there was this guy on the radio, WSB, named Fiddlin' John Carson, and was persuaded, well, you ought to record him too. And much to his surprise, found a ready market to buy those records, and that helps get this thing started.
I'd been married a long time ago, never had a been
And then we go back and trace the roots, because for centuries, really, what became known as country music rose up from the bottom up, as he said, from hymns, from ballads that had been brought over from the British Isles, black music, the blues, the banjo, which is an instrument that came from Africa, from work songs, from minstrel shows. And all these things had been passed really from person to person, family to family. And in 1923 in Atlanta, it started to take its next step in a way to reach more people and affect the culture more broadly. And that was through the brand new technology of radio and the older technology of recording. But up until the 1920s, this kind of music was not really recorded because it was viewed, as it has been for many years, sort of looked down upon as sort of a lesser form of art. We think it's a uniquely American form of art and an important one, and that's what our film is all about.
Well, among those recorded by Ralph Peer, Jimmy Rogers, known to many as the father of country music. Let's hear a little bit of his song, Blue Yodel. Something we associate with country music, that yodel. Where did he come up with his sound?
Well, Jimmy Rogers, like all great artists, drew from everything around him. He absorbed everything. He was a vagabond. He worked on the railroads when he was a kid, and he sopped up the music of the predominantly African-American road crews working around him. He was a water boy for them. He soaked up the rest of the music surrounding him. And back in the 1840s, I think it was, America was taken by storm by some Tyrolean yodeling groups that went through the country. And Jimmy Rogers made that his trademark. He was the blue yodeler. And that tells you two things. The yodel, which comes from Austria, but the blue is the thing that came from African-American music. And it was his trademark. His wife said he yodeled around the house all the time. Everything, when he spoke, he would throw a yodel in. And I don't think there's any song that he recorded, and he recorded a lot in his short life, that didn't have a yodel in there at one point or another.
And you said blues was being recorded at this time. Ma Rainey, Blind Willie McTell, both from Georgia.
Now look at him, mama, let me tell you this.
Lead Belly, Skip James, all for the same record companies that these early hillbilly, as they were called, records. So how was country differentiated since it drew from all of these traditions?
Well, you know, part of it is actually just marketing. Ralph Peer was a genius. he had already made a name for himself by seeing a niche in the recording market for all the immigrant community. So he was producing records in Lithuanian and German and Russian and Italian. And he also, in essence, discovered that there was a market in African-American communities for someone to record blues music. And that's why he came to Atlanta originally in 1923 to record more of what was then called, quote, race music. And he came across fiddling John Carson, and he was playing old-time fiddle tunes and was persuaded to record it. It turned out to be a hit. And so he started recording more of that kind of music. And for lack of a better term, it was called hillbilly music for a long, long time before it eventually started to be called country western and then country music. And as Jimmy Rogers, rambling type of guy, another who peer recorded in 1927, he also recorded that year the Carter family from Virginia, and they represented sort of a different style of country music. Him, you know, based more on hymns, songs about mother, old ballads, and we like to think of it as there's a Saturday night and a Sunday morning in country music. Saturday night, you know, you go out howling at the moon, you ramble, you go in the jailhouse now, as Jimmy Rogers sang. That's what he was, that side of the coin, and that other great act of the 20s, the Carter family, were the Sunday morning, where you go pay your penance for what you did on Saturday night.
Dayton Duncan is with us. He's one of the producers and the writer for the upcoming Ken Burns documentary about country music. Let's hear "Can the Circle Be Unbroken" by the Carter family.
I was standing by the window on one cold and cloudy day.
Can the Circle Be Unbroken by the Carter family, one of those recorded by Ralph Peer in the 1920s. Do I have that right?
That's right, 27.
So this is arguably their most famous song. What is that song connecting to that made it a hit?
Well, I think you put your finger on it. It connects to everything. Actually, it had been a hymn that had been written in 1907. And in the 1920s, an African-American minister reworked it a little bit. A.P. Carter, who was credited as the songwriter for the Carter family, and a lot of the things he got was borrowed from existing songs, but he reworked it some more to have it more of the story. It is, on the one hand, a very sad story. I mean, what is sadder than you're standing by the window on a cold and cloudy day and you saw the hearse come rolling for to carry my mother away? Your mom's died. Mm. And it has all that sadness and that grief, and yet the chorus, you know, will the circle be unbroken by and by, Lord, by and by, there's a better world awaiting in the sky, Lord, in the sky. So it has this great hope as well. And that song reverberated to everyone who heard it. It's both sad and mournful, and yet it offers a promise of reunification. And I think that's what country music at its best is, an exploration of things that are universal of the human experience and human emotions. And there's nothing more universal and more elemental than the death of someone you love.
So A.P. Carter was one of those early song catchers like Alan Lomax, like Ralph Peer, who would go travel around for inspiration and recording songs. And despite the racism of the Jim Crow South, he traveled with a black friend named Leslie Riddle. So we're getting this picture of the mix of black and white, differently maybe than we imagined it. And of course, a little further west, there was Bob Wills and his Texas Playboys. Here's musician and composer Wynton Marsalis from the documentary comparing that band to swing.
The solo is like a jazz solo on top of it. The organization is like a jump band of 1930s kind of jazz swing band. You have some type of swing rhythm. Ding, 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 ding. Then you can have somebody soloing on that form.
Yeah.
mean, it's our way. Louis Armstrong on records would always say, "Oh, play that thing, Mr. Johnny St. Cyr." And Louis Armstrong didn't invent it, but it's part of a kind of Southern tradition of a self. This is so-and-so playing this instrument.
But you think that's too fiddle.
And Bob Wills was definitely like that, a showman.
So this Bob Wills out of Texas, imitating Louis Armstrong, Mamie Smith, innovating, also an innovator in the genre. He introduced drums to hillbilly music, encouraged his steel guitar player to use an amplifier, and using these little, aha, you know, he was breaking the rules. The record company didn't want that. What is the place of that kind of busting through in country music?
Well, that's what art is. This is an art form created by artists. And what do? They always try to push the boundaries. They always try to reach across what are arbitrary boundaries that, you know, people might construct or labels might construct or culture might construct. And what we learned in doing this film is how omnipresent that was. Country music has a very voracious appetite, and it reaches across and draws from other art forms, musical art forms. So Bob Wills takes the swing era, and he likes that music. He, too, grew up interacting with African-American kids. He played with a band in New Mexico with Hispanic musicians, and San Antonio Rose's great song sort of has some influence of that. So they're absorbing these things and trying to create something a little different. And time and time again, over the course of the 20th century, which is what we follow in our film, you see those things happening. And you also see how, you know, other genres of music try to absorb country music. Ray Charles, who, though he grew up in Florida, was born here in Georgia, is another great example. It didn't just go one way of white musicians borrowing things from African-American ones. When Ray Charles, who was a gigantic force in rhythm and blues, when he was finally given his first chance to select what music he wanted to play on an album, what did he choose? He came out with an album called Modern Sounds in Country and Western Music. He sang Hank Williams songs. He sang a great Don Gibson song, I Can't Stop Loving You.
I can't stop wanting you.
It's useless to say. So I'll just live my life.
But he brought to it his sensibility, and he created a tremendous album. Willie Nelson said that in doing that, he thought Ray Charles did more for country music than any single artist. Vince Gill in our film talks about it as well, that he was demonstrating, Ray Charles was, how soulful country music actually is. And a lot of times you mentioned in the Jim Crow South, a lot of times where the culture is trying and the society is trying to separate people, what music is doing all the time is bringing us together and showing us that those kind of strictures and those kind of fences really shouldn't exist. Music is the art of the invisible, and it knows no boundaries, and art knows no boundaries, and country music is, I think, one of the prime examples of that.
Georgia's own Ray Charles bringing it all together there with I Can't Stop Loving You. We're going to take a quick break and be back with Dayton Duncan. He's one of the producers and the writer of the upcoming Ken Burns documentary series about country music. Stay with us for some of the unexpected voices of this quintessentially American art form. This is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott.
Whenever I chance to meet some old friends on the street,
We're listening to Charlie Pride with Kiss an Angel Good Morning as we continue our conversation about country music, the subject of Ken Burns' new documentary. It's going to be airing on PBS beginning September 5th. GPB is presenting partner for a two-hour premiere tonight at the Atlanta History Center, and again on Wednesday, April the 10th at Savannah's Jepson Center. I'm speaking with Dayton Duncan. He's one of the producers, a longtime collaborator, and the writer for the documentary. We heard that song from Charlie Pride, heard about Ray Charles and the soulful contribution he brought to country music. But Charlie Pride, one of very few African Americans to be successful in the genre. How do you get a start?
He was born in a sharecropper's family in the Mississippi Delta and dreamed big dreams of doing something other than picking cotton. He saw Jackie Robinson break the color barrier in baseball and thought, well, maybe that's my way out. And he became a very good baseball player, ultimately didn't make it in the big leagues. But while he was doing that, he also had grown up listening to the Grand Ole Opry on the radio. He loved Hank Williams songs and two Opry stars. Visiting Helena, Montana, of all places, heard him and said, man, what a voice this guy's got. And he does have a great voice.
Kiss an angel good morning and love her like the devil when you get back home.
And they encouraged him to come to Nashville, where he finally broke through and recorded a number of great songs. At a time, 1960s, when it was the record producers, when they first released the records, didn't make note of the fact that he was an African-American. Once people got used to his voice, then that color barrier broke.
Until he was on a showcase in Detroit, I guess it's 1966. We've got a little clip from your documentary. The disc jockey Ralph Emery and Charlie Pride are telling the story. Emery originally was there. He introduces him. The audience is going wild. And then Charlie Pride walks onto stage.
Well, this is exactly the way it went. Yay! It stopped.
He could drop a pin.
Ladies and gentlemen.
I said, ladies and gentlemen, I realize it's kind of unique, me coming out here on a country music show wearing this permanent tan. The minute I said that, a big applause. So I guess they said, well, let's sit back and see what he got to offer.
So Charlie Pride did win him over in the end. But do you think, given the African-American roots that we talked about of country music, was that ever acknowledged in country music in an open way?
Not really. I mean, I think that there was one of the earliest stars on the Grand Ole Opry was an African-American, the harmonica wizard, Dee Ford Bailey, who thrilled audiences. He had a song called The Pan American in which he sounded like a train was coming through your house and picking up speed. And then Charlie Pride was really the next one. So what we try to show is that while society and culture has tried, and Wynton Marsalis, who appears occasionally in our film, the great jazz musician and more or less the main talking head, if you want to call it that, in the jazz series, points out that, you know, our DNA cries out for inclusion and spreading, and tribalism tries to separate it. But music is a great antidote to that. And so while there haven't been that many prominent African-American country stars, that's more a comment, I think, on us as a society than it is on the music itself. And I think that's the other thing that we try to get across in our series. Listen to the music. There is a Charlie Parker, the great bebop artist, jazz bebop artist. Was in a bar in New York City with his fellow musicians, his jazz musicians, and he went over the jukebox and he kept putting the nickels in to play country songs. And they said, Charlie, what the heck? I mean, why are you listening to that? And he said, it's the stories. Mm. Listen to the stories. And I think that's where country music really is at its best, is telling those stories.
Yeah. Yeah, and one of those great storytellers, Loretta Lynn, fantastic.
She's the best.
But it's also interesting that when Charlie Pride won the Country Music Association Award for Male Vocalist of the Year, he did that 2 years in a row, she presented the award, and she actually hugged him and kissed him on stage. So is there a distinction here between, you know, what the audience will accept and what his peers thought of him?
You know, he was well-liked. He became great friends with Farron Young, who was sort of an unlikely person, let me put it that way, that would become the best friend of a black man. But they formed this bond through their music, and Farron Young stood up for him when some radio executives learned that this guy that they were playing on the radio was black. One of the DJs at a convention told Farron, said, "Well, now that we've learned that, we're not playing his records anymore." And Farron set him straight and said, "If you just go back and tell those people they take Charlie's records off, they got to take mine off too."
Mm. Hello, Wendy.
Hello.
Well, I see that you're still here.
And they became great friends. Loretta Lynn, who is a great songwriter in her own right. And at that same time that Charlie was coming out, she was writing songs like Don't Come Home A-Drinkin' With Lovin' On Your Mind, a great feminist tract, if you think of it, you know, if you really start to think about it, though she would not have called herself a feminist. But she was writing songs that, as some people point out in her film, nobody was addressing issues of spousal abuse or you know, alcoholism in a family, but she was.
And don't come home a-drinkin' with lovin' on your mind.
And she was always this unfiltered, straight-talking, great songwriter. And when they had told her, "Now listen, if Charlie Pride wins it, just you step back from the podium." It's a comment on her and a comment on a lot of things. But she hugged him and she said, you can't let somebody tell you where to stand and where not to. At least I can't. And that's Loretta, deep down Loretta.
She also came up against country music establishment, let's put it that way. She wrote her song about taking the pill.
I'm tearing down your brooder house, 'cause now I've got the pill.
And the country music stations didn't want to play it. The record company held it back for a couple of years. This is right when Women's Lib is going on. Was country music providing an avenue for empowered women? We don't necessarily think of that.
Our series is just crammed with some incredibly strong women. I mean, you think going back to the start, the Carter family was two women and a guy. And those two women, Sarah had the great voice, and Maybelle Carter, her styling on the guitar called the Carter Scratch, is credited as one of the great influential guitar styles in American music. Rose Maddox was just this firecracker of a singer and force of nature. Kitty Wells sang a song when there was a popular song called The Wild Side of Life, that a man complaining that his wife, he didn't know that God made honky-tonk angels. And she came out with the song, "It wasn't God who made honky-tonk angels." And the point of the song was, too many married men think they are still single.
Too many times married men think they're still single.
That has led, you know, many a good girl
to go wrong.
Yeah. You know, she's saying it right out there. Patsy Cline, my goodness. You know, she could swear like a sailor and called everybody hoss and wouldn't let promoters cheat her band. Yet she had this overpowering voice.
Crazy. I'm crazy for feeling so lonely.
And a great heart, put her broad embrace around little Brenda Lee out on tour and protected her, and they became good friends. And then there's Loretta and Dolly Parton and Reba McEntire, and you go on and on. There's a long list.
Well, let's hear a little bit of Dolly Parton. This was Jolene.
Jolene, 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 Jolene. Please don't take my man.
And it just has that heartbreaking line, please don't take him just because you can. Unbelievable. What is she tapping into that hits us?
She, again, when it's at its best, country music is just, it penetrates your heart with these elemental emotions. As Holly Williams, the granddaughter of the great Hank Williams and the daughter of Hank Williams Jr. says during that segment, that is like Hank Williams, too. You take the most simple words, the most simple emotions, and you turn it into something that just sticks with you. And Dolly's got a whole bunch of those kind of songs, and country music is just full of them as well.
Dolly also crosses over to pop. Other pop culture boundaries are just obliterated. She's in films. There's Dollywood, her theme park. Wrote songs for other musicians, and still a major force. And there was a Grammy tribute to her this year. Why do you think she's endured? Why do you think her story speaks to the endurance of country?
Well, I think you begin with any artist who endures. It's because they're just really good at what they do. And I think that people, you know, get a little bit, not distracted, but they focus on the hair and her personality, which is a force in itself, and overlook of what a tremendous songwriter she actually is. And she's got a great voice, too, and a great talent to present it. But as they say in Nashville, it all begins with a song. Somebody's got to write something. And if it's really good, if it touches on those things, and if you match it with an artist, sometimes the person who wrote it in the first place, you get that marriage of those things, and you get something that that will last forever. And she's got a share of those, for sure.
That's Dayton Duncan. He is the writer and one of the producers in Ken Burns' new documentary, Country Music. We talked just a minute ago about the strong women of country, but let's go back to that, the ramblin' fellow, you know, the kind of outlaw. And those images evolve, too. You have your Hank Williams, Johnny Cash, Dwight Yoakam, guys who gained popularity for telling the story of the common man. I think of Charlie Rich's song, you know, Life Has Its Little Ups and Downs. These are songs of people who just trying to make it in America, but also troubled men, troubled stories, some who did time or sang songs for those who did. Let's hear a little bit of that. This is Johnny Cash's Folsom Prison Blues.
When I was just a baby, my mama told me, son, always be a good boy, don't ever play with guns. But I shot a man in Reno just to watch him die.
So this is another breaking boundaries. The record company did not want him to make a record at Folsom Prison, and he also did a record at San Quentin Prison. How does this play out, this kind of you are not as good as in country music? There's a kind of defiance.
People have stories that they want to tell, and they have hard lives that they want to find some expression for that either gives them some solace or explains themselves to people, or just tells a story that they think is important. Johnny Cash is like he enters our film in episode 4, but he is a dominant force from that to the end of our film because he's a great artist, he has an interesting life, and it intersects with all these things. You know, I'm a writer. If I had made up the story that when he goes to sing at San Quentin Prison, that because he believes that he connects with these folks with his stories, and he derives a pleasure, if you will, out of connecting with those folks, because they remind him of where his roots are, that sitting in the audience is this 20-year-old kid who's doing hard time, who then is inspired by that, whose name is Merle Haggard, who goes on to be one of the greatest songwriters in country music history. If I wrote that in a novel, you know, the editor would, you know, strike it out. But at its heart, at its, you know, great beating heart of country music is this ability to strip things down to three chords and the truth, if you want to call it that, and say something on behalf of everybody, because it's universal, it's human, in many instances, human in a way that people tend to forget and or just ignore. And when it speaks loudly and penetratingly. Mama's Hungry Eyes, or just called Hungry Eyes by Merle Haggard, to me is a quintessential country song. It is a beautiful song, but it's all about, from the point of view of a child, in Merle's case, his father's hardworking hands trying to, you know, scrape by for his family and defeat his mama's hungry eyes.
Mama never had the luxury she wanted, but it wasn't 'cause my daddy didn't try.
It wasn't a rebuke of her father. It's just that, you know, she wanted the best for her kids. But as it says in the song, we had to learn that a better class of people kept us somewhere there below. One more reason for my mama's hungry eyes. I can relate to that.
I remember Daddy praying for a better way of life, but I don't recall a change of any size.
You know, your conversation with Dwight Yoakam, he is deeply moved and sort of breaks like your voice just broke talking about a Merle Haggard song. But what is it about the way that Merle sort of paints a picture that gets us right in the heart?
He's a poet, the poet of the common man, he was called. And that's what poets do. They find the right words. That's Hank Williams was the hillbilly Shakespeare. You know, Dolly Parton, Jolene, Loretta Lynn. Don't come home a-drinking with loving on your mind. That's poetry.
Well, let me pick up on that idea of evolving. And for, in the case of Merle Haggard, it was a kind of reconciliation with himself or the ability to be redeemed.
San Quentin, something happened to me there. There was a time where I came to the fork in the road and took it, you might say. And kind of started back in the other direction, trying to make something out of myself rather than to dig myself in a deeper hole.
So this is something, Dayton, that I think comes up a lot. You know, the kind of idea of, you know, we have these kind of outlaw, rambling guys, you know, Bob Wills, Hank Williams, alcoholics, womenizers, you know, got themselves into trouble, certainly. And then you've got these flawed figures, but then this increasingly vision of country musicians as the all-Americans, the good old boys, you know, trucks and beers and mama and you know, the Okie from Muskogee, the clean, we don't burn our draft cards, we're something else in country music. So what does that kind of rejection of a whole way of life mean in this music?
Well, I think a lot of people have their own stereotypes of what they think country music is. And every time that happens, it's like a narrow silo of assumption about what it is. Is it that? Sure. And it's this, and it's this, and it's this, and it's this, and it's this. It's you know, a broad embrace of topics. It's a broad embrace of musical styles. In the case of, you know, the truck drivers and all that, I mean, Willie Nelson, when he gave up on Nashville, he had a lot of great hit songs for other people, Crazy by Patsy Cline and Nightlife by Ray Price, but he couldn't make it as on his own as a singer because they kept trying to pigeonhole him, you know. He has a little too much jazz in him. His phrasing is odd. His guitar playing is a little different. When he got back down into Texas in the 70s, he found there a community of people, mostly young, almost a generation younger than him, who loved his music, and also the truck drivers. And so he was playing at places where he started his 4th of July picnics, and he said, so people come and drink beer and find out they didn't hate each other. You know, there are rednecks and long-haired hippies coming to his music, because his music speaks, as he says in our film at a later time, music will get through. You know, it's not a Democrat or a Republican. It's music, and it doesn't know the boundaries. And so he's an outlaw. He was called part of the outlaw movement, and he said, well, everybody's got a little outlaw in them, and I sort of took it as a compliment. But he also came out with an album against his label's wishes of old standards like Stardust and Georgia on My Mind, I might add, that the record company says, why are you doing that? He said, well, I've learned that when if I slip a couple of these standards in to my concerts, that the audience loves it. The young kids think I might have written it, and the older folks recognize it for what it is and love just hearing it again. Well, that album called Stardust stayed on the chart for like 4 years. Country music is not Beethoven, right? And it's not necessarily disco. And so there is a necessity sort of to have a name for something. But when it becomes constrictive, or when it tries to tell you that it's just one thing, then it becomes meaningless. And I think that's what we keep trying to explore in our series, is that it wants to reach out and express itself, and that people respond to it when they respond to it as music and sort of set aside all these other things.
We're getting a preview of the upcoming Ken Burns documentary series, Country Music, with Dayton Duncan. He's one of the producers and the writer for the series. We're listening to Georgia on My Mind as we head into a short break. But stay with us for more of On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott.
Just an old sweet song keeps Georgia on my mind.
From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott, continuing a conversation with Dayton Duncan. He's a longtime collaborator with Ken Burns, and he's a producer and writer for Country Music. That's an 8-part documentary series launching on September 15th. But we're giving you a little preview, and audiences in Atlanta can see one tonight at the Atlanta History Center. It's also showing on April 10th in Savannah. The last sprawling epic of country music on film was Nashville, Robert Altman's 1975 satire of the genre's star-making machinery, populist political tendencies, and earnest patriotism. Among a large cast of characters is Haven Hamilton, a pompadoured send-up played by Henry Gibson, here singing, "We Must Be Doing Something Right to Last 200 Years."
I share our country's motto, and in God I place my trust.
Dayton, we talked before the break about some really big names, Dolly, Loretta, Johnny Cash, etc. But from there, the market and the industry appears to take over during the 70s and 80s. That's my observation. You can correct me on that. But I think of that, the film Nashville, a send-up of country music sentimentality. What do people in the country music industry think of it?
Well, when Robert Altman's crew started doing their film Nashville in Nashville, the country music community was very excited that at last, maybe they would be taken seriously and will destroy all the old stereotypes. And when the film came out, it was viewed critically acclaimed as this satirical look at all of America and using the culture there in Nashville as its example of hypocrisy and money grubbing and also ending in violence. And it got critical acclaim as a comment on sort of mainstream of America. And they hated it in Nashville because they thought, well, once again, we're being caricatured and made fun of. But at that same time, country music, which always has had this debate, what is country music, right? That debate is, on the one hand, continual and important, and on the other hand, it also takes place when artists are just saying, it's over here, no, it's over here, no, it's over here. And the 70s was one of those great decades for that. You had Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, and the Outlaws. You had, on the other extreme, what was called the smooth country politan sound. You had sort of bohemian writers like Townes Van Zandt. You had Johnny Rodriguez broke through, the first major Mexican-American country star. And you had a person that I think is a transformational figure in the history of country music, and her name is Emmylou Harris, who was originally a folkie. She got brought out to sing on a duet album, actually on a solo album of Gram Parsons, who's a guy himself who had been a folkie, then converted to country music and helped sort of start what became known as country rock. He called himself a cosmic cowboy. And he took her through this tutorial of Merle Haggard, the Leuven Brothers, all the great stars, Buck Owens and those folks. And after he died prematurely from alcohol and drug abuse, these albums she made in tribute to him were all these country songs, but reinterpreted by her. And she was cool, you know? She was a 70s person, and she had
she was a hippie.
And she was a hippie, and she had a great band with her, including Rodney Crowell, the Hot Band, it was called. And she just sort of crossed every border there was. They, you know, she opened for Elton John, and she also opened for James Taylor, and she also did things, you know, at the Grand Ole Opry. Johnny Cash once said, every once in a while, country music's got to get back to Emmylou Harris. She just she just embraced it all. And she said, this is all great music. And it's not great music that you have to just repeat it, you know, each generation has to slavishly copy it. But you, if you connect to those roots and then give it your interpretation, that's when it's at its best. And she inspired not only a lot of listeners, myself included in that decade, but a lot of artists. Dwight Yoakam credits her as the sort of the lodestar to which he gravitated to go out to California from Kentucky. She was a great inspiration to Roseanne Cash, who, though the daughter of the giant Johnny Cash, is in her own right an independent, excellent singer-songwriter, that listening to Emmylou Harris and meeting her helped give her the more courage to write her songs that had their own sensibility based on her own experiences just as much as her daddy's experiences had influenced his music. So Emmylou is just a marvelous person in the evolution of country music. And I hope one of the things that our film series does is to help people recognize that not only does she have an angelic voice, but she was an important person at an important time in the evolution of this great American music.
She was called by Rolling Stone country without the corn. And I think the corn is where a lot of people get hung up. Certainly, that was my view growing up. You know, hee-haw was what country music was. It wasn't serious, and it wasn't about the songs. It was about a kind of personality that was put forward. And there was a kind of defiance in that personality. I think of George Jones and Tammy Wynette singing, "We're Not the Jet Set."
No, we're not the jet set. We're the old Chevrolet set. There's no Riviera in Festus, Missouri.
We're common people, and we're celebrating that. You may look down on us, and it makes me think about the whole we're the ignored people. We're not the elites. Do you think there is a political stirring that accompanies country music in the way that a lot of people, let's, you know, think of election 2016. They said, you've left us out of the conversation.
Well, I think that the history of country music touches on that, certainly. I think you'd be laying too much on to say that country music is, you know, creates that culture. It's an expression of it. It's an expression of saying, I've got something to say. Listen to me. and that responds to just stereotypes about it. You know, there was a deliberate by some of the marketers effort to play to the rube, to play to the hay bales and those things. And some of the musicians were happily, you know, okay, that's fine. Others resented it. As Dolly says in our film, you know, if you're a hillbilly, you can call yourself a hillbilly. But if you're not, and you're using the phrase in a way that, you know, that doesn't understand us, then it's, you know, it's almost like a racial slur. Mm. And I think that's been part of country music's evolution, and I think part of that was probably evident in 2016. It's you know, I think there is a yearning for people to have their story told, whether it's in music or just in recognition by the people who make decisions. But they, while they're linked in one sense, that one doesn't cause the other, I don't think.
Well, that question of authenticity has been a big part of country music. A couple of years ago, Blake Shelton, he's one of the celebrity coaches on The Voice, he called classic country fans old farts and jackasses.
Truck bed loaded down with beer and a cold one in my life.
And others came back, and, you know, there are people like Tyler Childers, I think of, Chris Stapleton, who reject the auto-tune being used in country music or synth-pop being used in country music. So this fight has been going on for a long time over a genre that, as you're saying, you know, ties all things together. Is this the corruption of the business of country or what's going on there?
You know, I think that those things that you just described about modern country, which we don't deal with in our film, as I say, we end in the mid-1990s in our storytelling. But what you see in the stories that we tell and in the history that we cover is that, as Ecclesiastes says, there's nothing new under the sun. Hmm. And so all those tensions have been there from the start. And for every artist who is old style, there are artists in history who are saying, no, I want to move this over here and move it forward and change it a little bit. So for every Blake Shelton today and every Chris Stapleton today and every Jason Isbell of today, they have their counterparts in the history of country music. And so we make a mistake, I think, again, to try to confine it by what we think country music is and what we think it represents. It's an art. It's music. And there's some really bad country songs, just as there's a lot of bad any music genre. But at its best, and what we try to get to is its beating heart and its core, at its best, it is speaking to everybody. And it doesn't matter, while it springs from the bottom up, it talks to everybody from the bottom all the way up and across all racial lines, across all ethnic lines, across all gender lines. And those are the songs that will endure and the artists that will be remembered. And those are ones that we spend a little more attention to those great things than we would do of saying, and here's 10 minutes about the things that, you know, the music when it wasn't really very good.
Well, this is something that you came under criticism, under fire for Ken Burns' documentary on jazz, that you stopped too early.
On the one hand, people complain they're so long, 16 and a half hours, and then you get the complaints about the things you left out. So it's a, you should have seen the 32-hour version of country music, and maybe some of those things that people will feel were left out. They're probably, we might have had that story in when we started, but we are constricted by time limits and other things that are telling stories. But the other point that you're making about where do you stop? As I said, the reason we stop, because we're historians and we're not journalists. So if you wanted to say of today, you could make your best guess of who you think in country music, in this example, would be the person that 20 years from now you would look back on and you would say, oh, that it was that person, wasn't it? Or it was that song that really had an impact versus just was the most popular.
as the years went slowly by. She still preyed upon his mind.
And so that's why we do what we do, because we do have to make these decisions, and we try to work as hard as we can to make ones that are justifiable and that will stand the test of time. And that is what history is. History is looking back on something. That's what we do. We try to do it as good as we can. And if, like I say, if people complain that you didn't bring it up to date, we can say, well, 20 years from now, I may not be around, but somebody can do that to get those 20 years that we're missing. Or somebody can make another film that would come to different conclusions than we have in terms of the stories that we decide to tell.
Dayton Duncan, he's producer and writer for Country Music, an 8-part documentary series launching on September 15th. Audiences in Atlanta can see a preview tonight at the Atlanta History Center and on Wednesday, April 10th at the Jepson Center in Savannah. We've got a trailer posted online at gpbnews.org. And we'll leave you to ruminate on George Jones singing He Stopped Lovin' Her Today. On Second Thought is produced by Elena Rivera, Leighton Rowell, LaRaven Taylor, and special thanks today to Amelia Brock. Alex Word is our engineer, Don Smith, our dean of grammar, and Amy Kiley is senior producer. I'm Virginia Prescott. If the good Lord's willing and the creek don't rise, we'll see you next time for On Second Thought.
He stopped loving her today. It placed her